You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, June 7th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jonathan Taplin, Director Emeritus of the USC Annenberg Innovation Lab, author of Move Fast and Break Things. How Facebook, Google, Amazon corrupted our culture and undermined democracy. Also on the program today, intelligence chiefs Rogers and Coates won't say if Trump asked them to downplay the Russia probe. Our lips are sealed. Meanwhile, Comey apparently told Sessions, don't leave me alone with him. Let's go to the bathroom together.
I guess he is a bit unstable. Always talking about Puerto Ricans, too.
The Kansas laugher-made disaster may be coming to an end. Meanwhile, the apple does not fall far from the tree. Eric Trump funneled cancer charity money into his business. And turns out that wall is beautiful and solar. Meanwhile, in the Senate, McConnell closer to forging a repeal and replace bill. Twitter users blocked by Donald Trump claim it violates their First Amendment rights. Trump supposedly to nominate a new FBI head, Chris Christie's former lawyer. ISIS attacks Iran. And lastly, new evidence that lead is a contributor to crime rates. All that and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, As we speak, Dan Coats, Mike Rogers, the Director of National Intelligence and the head of National Security Agency have basically, they haven't quite denied it, but they aren't quite confirming it. They're just not prepared to talk about it now as to whether or not Donald Trump asked them to quash or to inhibit Comey's investigation. So that leaves us with Comey's talk in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee tomorrow. And, you know, they're trying to downplay expectations, saying that he will not say that Trump obstructed justice. Maybe that just means he will not say the words obstructed justice. We just don't know. But and I wouldn't have outsized expectations for this tomorrow, folks. But it could still very well be interesting. And apparently it's making Donald Trump very angry. And like we said yesterday, the more unhinged this guy is in terms of an inability to focus on legislation, the better. But nevertheless, in the Senate, Mitch McConnell seems to be doing his darndest to destroy our health insurance. And so we will get a sense of that later in the program. Also, very important that we talk about what's happening in Kansas, because in my estimation, it has been political malpractice that the words Kansas disaster or the Kansas, I don't know, kerfuffle. I don't know what you would say. I mean, we all know about the Kansas catastrophe. I mean, we'll get to the story later. But in 2012, Sam Brownback, taking advice from Arthur Laffer, literally taking advice from him, pushed through stunning tax cuts that 5 years later have had the impact of destroying Kansas's economy and wreaking havoc on its basic services. And basically, the legislature yesterday, in vetoing or overriding Sam Brownback's veto to raise taxes, has basically said, guess what? Major F up. But the idea, because the tax cuts we're seeing in Kansas, we're going to see them come out of a Republican House and Senate. And the idea that the words Kansas catastrophe or whatnot, you know, the flip side of the Massachusetts miracle that we wasn't terribly effective. The idea that we don't, that this is not rolling off the tongue, that as soon as I say Kansas catastrophe, people don't know what I'm talking about or something to that effect, is political malpractice. But I guess we'll talk more about that later. Right now, what I want to talk about is the fact that we're now, what, 12 days away? 11 days away?
I think it's 12.
From Father's Day. And I know a lot of you out there haven't even thought about what you're going to get your dad, because you're bad people.
Yeah.
Speaking as a dad.
I think it's really a sign of courage how honest you are about
it. I know it's exactly 11 days.
Well, all right, there you go. Many of you are looking for the perfect Father's Day gift, or even just like a Father's Day gift. Do you want to avoid the last minute hustle? Omaha Steaks. For only $49.99, you can get my limited time Father's Day package when you go to omahasteaks.com. Enter my code REPORT in the search bar. REPORT in the search bar. You got to do it in the search bar. It's 80% off its normal cost. You get 2 filet mignons, 2 top sirloins, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 boneless pork chops, 4 burgers, 4 jumbo franks, a 12-ounce package of all beef meatballs, 1 pound of fries, 4 caramel apple tartlets, which in my experience, that is basically one serving for someone my size and someone who looks exactly like me. 1 Omaha Steak seasoning packet, plus get 4 additional burgers free. All of this for less than $50. Folks, these are great steaks. And what could be better? You have a huge cookout for Father's Day, or you keep them in the freezer and you eat steak for, I don't know, sometimes some people, I don't know, once or twice a month, sometimes once a week, sometimes more.
Sometimes nightly.
Sometimes nightly, if you're Matt Leck and you were raised in
nightly.
Not anymore. I used to when I lived in Fargo.
If you're looking for a convenient and quick Father's Day gift, go to omahasteaks.com. Enter my code REPORT in the search bar. Add the family gift pack to your cart. You get an 80% savings. Grab your dad. Fire up the grill. Or really, I mean, you let your dad do it, because that's basically all we got left as dads. We're in charge of the grill. Although I got to say, I played softball yesterday, and I mean, there's at least one or two people who play with me who are listening to the show, and they know. I mean, I played out of this world. It was weird. People were sort of blown away. I mean,
everyone sang it.
I had, I think, 3 triples. And I'm completely lame right now with this sciatica.
But you have the look of softball about you, Sam.
It's, you know, don't knock it.
Okay, Rachel.
Three triples. Though. Let's, that's good.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm just placing the ball. It's just, I don't even get into it.
Unbelievable.
All right. Let's cover one clip from Karen Handel and John Ossoff, who debated last night in Atlanta. This election is about 20 days away, not even 17 days away. And I have to say, I don't know what's going on the ground. I haven't seen any recent polling. The last one I think I saw, Ossoff was up by 4 points, 51 to 47, I think it was. But I would be very surprised if this debate helped Karen Handel. Here is Karen Handel and John Ossoff debating over minimum wage. Now, remember something. John Ossoff, for our taste here on this program, in a vacuum, would be less than a stellar candidate from our perspective. Okay? He is going to come from the more sort of, I don't want to say corporatist because that remains to be seen, but my sense is he's going to be on the more sort of corporate-y side of the Democratic Party. Now, remember, he's also coming from Georgia at this point. But this just goes to show you, you've got minimum wage, an increase in the minimum wage is a universal value in the Democratic Party now. And here's Karen Handel. I cannot imagine her handlers wanted her to say something like this.
Go. Does either candidate support a minimum wage increase? Mr. Ossoff starts with you.
Yes, I do. The minimum wage should be a living wage. I think we can raise it indexed to the cost of living because the cost of living varies widely in urban and rural areas and in different states across this country. I think that increase needs to be implemented at a pace that allows business owners to adapt their business plans so they're not shocked. Their business plans are not shocked by a sudden increase in labor costs. But look, if someone's working a 40-hour work week, they deserve the kind of standard of living that Americans expect. That's part of the American dream, and there are too many folks who are having trouble making ends meet.
Minimum wage.
This is an example of the fundamental difference between a liberal and a conservative. I do not support a livable wage. What I support is making sure that we have an economy that is robust with low taxes and less regulation so that those small businesses that would be dramatically hurt if you impose higher minimum wages on them are able to do what they do best, grow jobs and create good paying jobs for people in the 6th District.
I have a feeling they did not want her to say that she does not believe people should have a livable wage. I'm just guessing.
See where you're going there, but maybe we could dial it back a little bit. We want everyone to have a minimum wage through not having a livable wage. Something like that might work.
If people are kept from having livable wages, they'll grow jobs and wages.
I want people to make more than a livable wage.
That's why people start small businesses. Not to make money themselves, but to create jobs for other people. I mean, I guess if your small business is a temp agency, but short of that, not the best of candidates. So, she makes John Ossoff look like, yeah. Well, all right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Jonathan Taplin, Director Emeritus of the USC Annenberg Innovation Lab, on his book, Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, Amazon Corrupted Culture and Undermined Democracy. We'll be right back after this.
Home.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Director Emeritus of the USC Annenberg Innovation Lab, author of Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. Welcome to the program, Jonathan Taplin.
Thanks, Sam. Good to be here.
So let's start. I mean, by way of introduction, I should say your book is in part a memoir, but also, I guess, the policy lessons that you learned through your personal experience. And so let's start with the difference between the sort of the mythical, aspirational perspective of the internet and what it's become and how it became that way.
Well, you know, I came at this from my own personal experience when, you know, I started my professional life after Princeton as a road manager for Bob Dylan and the band. And I worked with the band for 3 years, and Levon Helm, who was the singer, made a good living for many years. And even though the band stopped recording in late 79, he continued to make money off the albums, because in the 80s, the CD came in and everybody kind of renewed their record collection. But in 2000, Napster happened. And at the same time, Levon got throat cancer. And so he couldn't go and tour and sing or act or do anything. And it just seemed to me extraordinarily unfair that I could go on YouTube and find 3 or 4 million streams of the band music and Levon died broke. And so for me, I began to think about, well, what had happened? How had all the money got reallocated from the people who made content, made music, made newspapers, to these giant monopoly platforms like Google, Facebook, and Amazon? And really, the story is a story of a libertarian takeover of the internet. The internet was supposed to be this incredibly decentralized force. But in the late 80s, people like Peter Thiel and Larry Page and Jeff Bezos came in and saw that really the internet was going to be a world in which the winner was going to take all. That there was going to be one search platform, there was going to be one set of social networks, there was going to be one e-commerce giant. And because of what is known as the network effect, they could totally dominate everybody else. And that is, in essence, what happens. These companies are the largest companies in the world today, much larger than General Electric or Citibank or other companies that used to dominate the top of the Forbes Fortune 100.
I don't think people realize just how large, and you mentioned that like 10 of the top wealthiest people in the world are basically all these internet players.
That's correct. The great amount of wealth created is all going to the tech sector. We used to think that the bankers were the rich guys, but they're pitchers compared to these guys like Bezos, Zuckerberg, and obviously Page and all these others. And it's pretty astonishing. And of course, what's happened to the music business is the revenues have fallen by 72%. Newspaper revenues have fallen by 75%. Book revenues have been completely compressed in profits, and now it's hitting the film and TV business too, because this is no longer just an issue of music files. It's with broadband, it's just as easy to put video files on.
Now what do you say to the argument that, well, look, there's I guess you got to move fast and break things. For some omelets to be made, some eggs have got to be cracked. And these are just sort of transitional pains, equivalent to the guys selling horse and carriages when the car comes in.
Right. So, look, I totally believe in innovation. I've run for the last 7 years the Annenberg Innovation Lab. And so I think technology can be a friend. But if you think about, is it improving things? That's a question. So just think about the news business. Is Facebook making news dissemination and distribution better or worse? I would argue it's making it worse, because basically it's a platform for people to put out absolutely untrue statements, things. And as my book proves, during the last election, the untruth was far more popular than the truth. And, you know, even Tim Berners-Lee said, you know, these kids in Macedonia who were manufacturing fake news realized that lies were more clickable than truth. And so that's where the money was. And if you get paid through Google AdSense and other ways to manufacture falsehoods, that to me is problematic. That's where the subtitle about, you know, undermining democracy comes in. Because really, quite frankly, we're living in a new world now. And, you know, last week, the British Prime Minister said, well, look, these guys who created the terrorist incidents in Britain in the last 6 weeks were all trained on the internet. Well, guess what? They went to YouTube, and you can go yourself right now. There are 4,000 videos from a guy named Anwar al-Awlaki, who got killed in a drone strike 2 years ago, but is still thought of as some kind of jihadist martyr, and is teaching you how to be a terrorist. And it's just sitting there on YouTube, because YouTube pretends it can't do anything about it.
But now, is this, all right, so, I mean, is that aspect of it the okay, so let's assume we had a policy addressing of this problem, right? I mean, we, on one hand, we have the problem of an antitrust problem, where there's three or four major internet companies, Google, Facebook, Amazon, who have stepped into the internet without any regulations and have used their market power to squeeze out things. I mean, Google is introducing, I think, sometime next year or soon, an ad blocker for Chrome, which is the most popular browser, that is essentially going to filter out all ads that are not Google ads. And Facebook.
Exactly.
And I mean, so I get that aspect of it. But the other aspect of, let's say we didn't, I mean, could you have, I mean, if you didn't have Google putting this stuff, it would be on LiveLeak, right? Or it would be on some version of Vimeo or whatever. I mean, is the problem, because look, and I think someone told me about your book, because we put Google videos out and was talking about how we got slammed because of the advertising model with Google. Now, I never, you know, wanted to rely on them only, so we don't. But also, it got into this conversation of there's a really bad feedback loop where if you do stuff like, does Hillary Clinton have Parkinson's, you're going to build your audience, and it's going to train you to sort of like, at the very least, even if you're not inclined to sort of hover around that area of questionable InfoWars type of stuff to make money. I mean, but those to me seem like two distinct problems, that it's corrosive to our culture and our democracy and the antitrust issues.
They are two distinct issues, but they blend in the following way. If the dominant forces on the internet are the people who carry this unfiltered garbage, then since they have the greatest audience, I mean, Facebook has 2 billion customers, Google has 2 billion customers, and they're the ones that are pushing out this stuff. It's not the New York Times or the Daily News or the ChicagoTribune.com that's pushing out fake news. It's these fake news sites which are enabled by Google and Facebook. So that's the first problem. The second problem is we all know that when there's a car crash, people go and stare. But the problem with the internet is it's becoming a constant car crash, and that's all that's there is people, you know, wandering by the car crash and staring at it. So that's the first one. The second problem with the antitrust issue is this. We have an administration now in which Donald Trump doesn't believe in regulating business. And that has been a problem for ever since Ronald Reagan. And there's no reason for me to believe that with Peter Thiel very close to the White House, that they would do anything to harm the business of Facebook, which he is still one of the largest shareholders. So I'm not positive that we can get changes at the antitrust level, at least not right now.
Right.
I talked to a very big investor who owns a huge portion of Google, Amazon, and Facebook, and he said, look, these guys are going to have to learn that they have to be a better player societally and clean up their act, or someday there might be an Elizabeth Warren in the White House who's going to kick their butt in the antitrust courts. Because it's not hard to make a convincing argument that Google, with 88% market share in search advertising, is a monopoly. So the two issues are, I agree, are separate issues, but in some sense they're blended, because what they are is about corporate power and how it's used. And if you have that much power, I'm suggesting that maybe there should be some responsibility to go along with it.
To a certain extent, it strikes me that the analogy is, it's one thing to have an investment bank gamble with highly leveraged securitized debt, but when you have all of it so codependent, it can take down our entire system. And that is the problem with this level of monopolies, is that it's one thing for Google to allow crappy stuff on YouTube, but it becomes exacerbated when it's the only player in town.
Exactly. And you think about this. 60% of Americans under the age of 40 believe that Facebook is their major source of news. So if Facebook is the major source of news, and Facebook's trending topics algorithm can be played by Steve Bannon or Cambridge Analytica or whoever, Russian bots, what effect does that have on society? I mean, before the French elections 3 weeks ago, Facebook shut down 40,000 fake accounts in France alone. So if there were 40,000 fake accounts being used by the Russians to play with the French election, how many do you think there were in the United States, which none of which were shut down before the 2016 election?
I have no idea, but I would imagine that there was, and even if it's just, I mean, even if it's just not necessarily the Russians creating fake accounts, even if it's just, I don't know, Robert Mercer or Sam Cedar,
exactly.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
Well, all right, let's go back and just talk a little bit about how profits have been extracted. I mean, you talk about basically two different ways, and that's, one is to squeeze the artists. And I mean, you talk about that in the context of Levon Helms, and
right.
And I think, you know, it strikes me that there's opportunities there too. I mean, the older model is problematic, but give us a sense of, like, in today's day and age, how could be different on that
right.
end. And then we'll talk about the surveillance marketing.
Okay. So look, there's extraordinary opportunities in the streaming music business. I was with an owner of a fairly large record label, earlier this week, and he said that the streaming revenue is up 80% year over year. So that says that's an incredibly good growing business. The problem is still that only a small fraction of music users and listeners are actually on the what are called the paid or premium models. That is Apple Music, Tidal, Spotify Premium, things like that. And those services pay the musician a decent amount of money. The problem is at the YouTube level, because YouTube essentially says to the record labels, look, your content is going to be on YouTube whether you like it or not, because we don't control it, the users do. And they're going to just put up your stuff. So all the only question you have to answer is, do you want a little bit of advertising revenue, a portion of what we make on this stuff, or not? So that's like an offer you can't refuse. But as the head of Warner Brothers Music puts it, that's not a willing buyer, willing seller. That's a holdup. So until we get YouTube out of that business and make YouTube act like Spotify and make an actual arm's length deal with the record labels, there will not be a really powerful streaming music business the way it could be. If we could clean up that, and that's a fairly simple deal, which is to get rid of the safe harbor law that makes it impossible for a musician to sue YouTube. I mean, just give you an example. If I had 1 million downloads on iTunes, I could make $900,000 as an artist. If I had 1 million streams on YouTube, I would make $900. That just doesn't work. That's an incredibly popular tune, and it makes $900? Forget it. So that part of the business can be cleaned up. The second thing that we really have to think about, though, is that these businesses are in what I call surveillance capitalism. And look, we all knowingly turn over gigantic amounts of data to them in return for the convenience. But let's think about where that's going. I had a neurobiologist come up to me 3 weeks ago on this book tour. He said, I just want you to know that the smartphone can record the tremors of Parkinson's in the same way it records the number of stairs you climb every day and put it in the same kind of place. And that data, of course, is sold by Fitbit and sold by all sorts of other companies to all sorts of people. But what if they start selling that data to your health insurance company?
Right.
I have worries about privacy, put it that way.
In regards to the safe harbor law, where do you draw that line where YouTube is responsible for what its users put up there? How do I make sure that I don't become liable in some fashion for what someone writes in a comment on my website?
Okay, so what you do is you fly a very narrow, what we call take down, stay down law. So if YouTube puts up a song that T-Bone Burnett doesn't want up there, then T-Bone Burnett files a takedown notice with YouTube, and YouTube obviously has the content ID, the kind of Shazam-like identifier of that song, and then it becomes YouTube's responsibility to keep that song off of YouTube, to keep it from getting even uploaded, just in the same way they block porn from getting uploaded to YouTube. They block that song. That's a fairly simple thing, and it just transfers the responsibility from the artist to keep playing this game of whack-a-mole with YouTube, because you tell them to take it down, they take it down, then it goes up the next day from another user. You make it YouTube's responsibility. That would profoundly change the economics of the music business.
And it
wouldn't make you responsible for some idiot comment gets on your website.
Well, we never have idiot comments on our side, but hypothetically speaking, all right. And so, from the surveillance marketing end of it, what is there? Is there a policy prescription for to deal with that problem?
Well, you know, I was at the Code conference last week. You know, kind of Daniel in the lion's den, presenting this thesis to the owners of Google, Facebook, Amazon, and all the other big tech companies. And Walt Mossberg, who is this very well thought of tech analyst who wrote for the Wall Street Journal for many years and then started Recode, said, we have to have a decent privacy law. He said, we need much stronger standards for security and privacy than now exist. It's time to stop dancing around the privacy and security issues and pass real binding laws. So that means you would have to opt in to letting people keep your data. You would have to, they would have to be very careful on when they use it, and they couldn't sell it to third parties without your permission. There would be a lot of conditions, and the Europeans have already passed the law to do this. It's not going to go into effect until May of 2018, and obviously Google and Facebook are fighting it very hard in the courts, but I think it's not like you couldn't do it.
Right.
It's possible to make a privacy law.
I guess I envision a situation where it's like, if you want to be on Facebook, you got to give us it all, everything, and then you're back.
Yeah, but you could have different levels of permissions,
right?
On Facebook. I mean, I really do think you could do that. And look, think about it this way: the Consumer Reports wrote this really amazing report on how auto insurance rates are set. So if two women live next door to each other in Brentwood, California, a nice suburban neighborhood, and one of them teaches downtown at a school in Watts, and the other stays in Brentwood, the woman who drives down to Watts every day will probably have auto insurance rates 20% higher than the other woman. You think your auto insurance rates are set by your driving record, but they're not at all. They're set by where you drive, because they're more worried about you getting your car stolen than they are about whether you're going to have a crash. And so, but they don't tell you that. They tell you, oh, safe driver. But guess where they get all the data? It's on your smartphone.
Mm.
Where you go.
Interesting. And opting in, and then I guess we're back again to the antitrust issue, because Facebook in that exchange with you has that much more power because it owns that entire space at this point. I mean, it's virtually impossible for someone to break in there because of the dominance that Facebook has in that area.
I mean, well, I think we've seen that in the last 4 months with Snapchat. You know, I mean, Snapchat had some really interesting, innovative things called Snapchat Stories, right, where you could kind of draw on pictures on top of photos, on top of video and stuff like that. It was pretty innovative. And Facebook offers to buy Snapchat for $3 billion, and Snapchat says, no, we don't want to be bought. We want to stay independent. And so Facebook essentially sets out to do exactly what Snapchat does just when Snapchat is going public, and essentially kills them. I mean, they stop their growth completely. They take Snapchat Stories and they call it Facebook Stories or Instagram Stories or WhatsApp Stories, and they don't even bother to change the name of the program. They just rip it off and push it out, and Snapchat stock goes from $28 to $14. Just kill them.
Was there any before Trump's election? Were you aware of any move within, maybe the antitrust division of the Department of Justice to address these type of things? Because I know there has been a movement to go away from the sort of Robert Bork version of what antitrust is about, which is you determine whether or not a monopoly is lowering prices for people versus what it's doing to society. I know there was a move away from that, but how far down the line had people gotten?
Well, look, there's a bunch of young scholars who really go back to Justice Brandeis's theory, which is that what the antitrust division is there for is to protect the little guy against the big guy. Not this Borkian notion that only thing that matters is price and consumer welfare. The problem is that those are really kind of rebellious scholars like Barry Lynn and, you know, his friends at New America, and they're not supported inside the administration, either Democrat or Republican. From the Republicans' point of view, they hate antitrust because they believe the free market always has the right solution. From a Democratic point of view, they supported antitrust for a while until Silicon Valley became the great source of money for Democratic politics after the labor unions were killed. The labor unions used to be the source of money for Democratic politics, but the Republicans made sure that they got wounded deeply. And so now they look to Silicon Valley. So quite honestly, Obama was terrible on this stuff. I mean, he let Google choose the assistant attorney general for antitrust. He let Google choose the person to run the patent office. He put Google people in the Federal Trade Commission and in the White House technology office and everything. So, I mean, he was just as bad as Reagan or Clinton or anybody. I mean, they've all been horrible on this, quite honestly. I mean, it's why it's shocking to people to realize how quickly these companies took over the economy. I mean, in my book, there's a chart that shows what the biggest companies were in 2006. And it was General Electric and Exxon and Citibank and those kind of companies. And now you look at it today and it's Apple, Google, Amazon, Microsoft and Facebook. That's the top five in the world.
And this is, you know, I mean, I think this is one of the things I think that Elizabeth Warren brings to the table is, in particular, is this sort of very strong awareness of the role of antitrust as it plays out in the context of these companies and going forward too, right? I mean, because we're just at the beginning of this, it seems to me.
Right. I mean, look, the destruction that these technology companies have wreaked on the creative economy is nothing compared to the destruction they're about to wreak on the rest of the economy. And I'll give you just an example. At this code conference, Mark Andreessen, who is a very major venture capitalist, a guy who thinks he's the smartest cat in the room and is not afraid to tell you that, he was discussing the autonomous truck business. So he basically made the assertion that in 10 years, most of the nation's truck would be done by driverless trucks. And the interviewer said, well, you know, most truck drivers are in their 40s and 50s. They're working class. They don't have college educations. What are you going to do with 4 to 5 million people that you're putting out of work? And he essentially said, that's not a problem. So you think about, I mean, as you well know, the mantra in Silicon Valley today is artificial intelligence. And that means robots. That means artificial intelligence replacing you know, entry-level lawyers. You know, right. Who needs an associate to do case research work when you've got a robot to do it? I mean, an AI assistant. So, I mean, I'm worried. I think these people have no clue as to what the havoc they are about to wreak on the economy. And it may be that in 50 years, it all works itself out. But in the middle, we might find ourselves in a kind of Blade Runner world if we're not careful.
Jonathan Taplin, author of Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that book at majority.fm. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, folks. We're going to move into the fun half. That's the thing. I wanted to get out of our, you know, just move slightly out of our normal silos of depressing politics into depressing monopolies
big
and antitrust.
Into,
you know, I mean, I think there is a quality of certain business models are set up that end up getting crushed. I think there's a certain inevitability that you're going to see, you know, some industries die, some industries grow, whatnot. But when you allow three companies to dominate, four companies to dominate the internet, which is obviously a huge, I mean, it's becoming an ever-increasing part of not just our economy, but of our consciousness. It's dangerous. And I think we've nibbled at this Apple from like multiple directions. But it is quite clear. I mean, they broke up AT&T. I don't know if you guys remember this, but it was they broke up the telephone company. And
Ma Bell?
Yeah. And that notion of antitrust, to have tolerated a Facebook or a Google or an Amazon for that matter, seems highly unlikely that that would exist. I mean, that, and, you know, this is something that we were anticipating more of. We had Barry Lynn on this program a couple of weeks before the election in anticipation. I mean, there was a lot of work being done in this space. And a lot of people are anticipating this was going to be a big push in a democratically controlled Senate with folks like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders ascending. I mean, there's a lot of people out there. We should probably have Stoller on the next thing he writes about this, where antitrust people are perceiving antitrust as a major, major contributor to not just this corrosion of our culture and our democracy, but also a big wealth inequality driver. But we'll get there. In the meantime, of course, you know, we still have the daily... what's going on here? Comey testifies tomorrow. Oh, God. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to head into the fun half of the program. And when we do, we're going to hear... we got a lot of things to talk about. We're coming up... Oh, we're just a day away now from the election in Great Britain.
Got some sound for you.
We've got sound of Eric Trump just completely disgusted by non-Eric Trump fans. Another clip from the Handel-Ossoff debate. all this and more on the program. And just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member of the Majority Report by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. It's your support that makes this show possible, honestly. So if you do have the financial means, please become a member today. If you don't, and you still want the bonus material that we give you every day, then send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We'll take care of you. Tomorrow on the program, I think my son will be sitting on the couch watching Paw Patrol.
Paw Patrol. Yep.
New series.
Matt, you ready to load those up?
Gonna be a lot of Paw Patrol around here tomorrow.
That kid is fast on the draw with that. He's like 10 seconds loading. Where's the new show?
Right, exactly.
This isn't a joke.
Apparently they, well, I'm not going to get into the deep into the Paw Patrol stuff, but 646-257-3920 is the number. Folks, if you like coffee and you drink coffee or you want to give it to somebody, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. I should also add that we have gifting at, and I can't remember what the name of the URL is now. I know it was something like cuck.org, but what was the other one that we had? What was the real one there? I don't even remember what it was. We have gifting. If you want to give the gift of the Majority Report, for now, just send us an email. I'll remember what that URL is. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Be right back after this. Sad.